3 weeks had passed since Shelley's evening with Tony at the bar, and she hadn't seen or heard from him again. They'd exchanged numbers in the car park before they parted ways. But when later that night she texted him a link to the open source folder that they used as a kind of internal database and message board, an innovation since his time at Burnham Wood, she'd received no reply. Of course, she'd reasoned, Tony's attraction to the cause had always been more theoretical than practical, and most of his closest friends in the group had long since moved on. And their more anarchistic activities, in which he might genuinely feel an interest, weren't recorded on the document anyway. Most likely, he had never actually intended to return to Burnham Wood as a fully-fledged member, and had only shown curiosity in her to be polite. Shelley tended to over-justify the actions of others whenever she knew she couldn't honestly justify her own. And since the night of Mira's departure, she'd been feeling both deeply ashamed of herself and deeply embarrassed. Ashamed that she had set out to betray Mira's trust so awfully, and embarrassed that she hadn't even come close to succeeding. She was determined to give Tony every benefit of the doubt. And as the days passed without any further sign of him, she even began to feel oddly grateful, as though his silence were in fact a kind of mercy, sparing her, graciously, from any chance to mortify herself again. She'd resolved to tell Mira he'd returned just as soon as Mira got home from Thorndyke. There was no reason, she'd decided, to break the news before then. After all, it wasn't as though Mira had been expecting him, and the news was hardly urgent, since he'd said himself that he was home for good. And while he evidently felt far more conflicted about what had happened at his leaving party than Mira had ever realized at the time, well, that was their own business, a matter to be discussed in person, not through a third party, or by text message, or over the phone. And anyway, Shelley thought, with dwindling conviction, nothing in Mira's intermittent texts from Thorndyke suggested that Tony had been in touch with her directly, so clearly he too felt the news could keep. She knew that she was in the wrong. But with Mira absent from the flat and no further word from Tony, it was not too difficult to put the matter out of her mind. Midwinter was a fallow time for Burnham Wood. There were succession plantings of spinach and silver beet to go in at the start of every week, and empty beds to dig over and prepare for the first crops of spring. But by this point in the season, the cabbages and cauliflowers were well enough established that they hardly needed cultivation, and the leeks and carrots had all been thinned. The work was light. The yield was steady, and the gardens mostly took care of themselves. The previous year they had planted Jerusalem artichokes in the abandoned earthworks of a stalled construction project out of town, and the crop had since run rampant. Digging up the tubers and bagging them for sale was Shelley's only major project in the first week of Mira's absence, and she completed it at leisure, relishing the solitude and experiencing a kind of preemptive nostalgia for all the years she'd given Burnham Wood. She had already begun looking for a job, and every day she found herself cataloguing, fondly, all the things that she would miss when she was gone. She spent her evenings updating the Burnham Wood Facebook page, putting out new calls for equipment and volunteers, posting before and after photos of their official plots around the city, and inviting hosts to share upbeat testimonials and post candid photos of their own. Mira had always regarded the page as a necessary evil, useful only in putting prospective hosts at ease. But it was Shelley who maintained it, and Shelley was too much her mother's daughter not to know that prospective employers would invariably cross-check the claims she made on her CV by turning to Facebook, where Burnham Wood was defined in carefully apolitical language as a grassroots community initiative that planted sustainable organic gardens in neglected spaces and fostered a commitment to helping those in need. As she posted that week's top tip for gardeners, "Bigger isn't always better when choosing seedlings from a garden store." She wondered if a part of her had always known, deep down, that she would one day want to leave the group. Maybe on some level she had curated the page specifically with her current circumstance in mind, namely in order to provide future employers with a coherent explanation for what Mira, in a cartoonish imitation of Shelley's mother, had once called the lost years of her career. Over a fortnight passed without Mira making any mention of when she was planning to return. Their messages were brief and breezy, Shelley not wanting to give Mira any reason to cut short her trip. And Mira still mindful, clearly, of Shelley's need for space. She'd barely described the site at Thorndyke, except to say that the town was very quiet and conditions were ideal. And although the date of Burnham Wood's next full caucus hui was fast approaching, The group met quarterly, on the first Monday night of every February, May, August, and November. They both steered well clear of the subject. Late on the first Sunday night of August, Shelley was getting ready for bed and reflecting on the fact that the impending hui might well be the first that Mira had ever missed, when she received a text. Mira had big news and was heading home first thing in the morning in order to make an announcement to the group the following night. ?" Shelley messaged back. And a few seconds later, the reply came through. Crazy couple of weeks. Didn't want to get your hopes up earlier, but I think we might have actually broken good. I'll explain properly in person. See you tomorrow, XX. OMG, what? Shelley wrote, and then waited. But the receipt function that marked the message as delivered didn't update the tag to read. Mira must have already turned off her phone and gone to bed. The next morning, Shelley woke to see that her text was now marked red, but Mira had replied only to say that she was hitting the road and expected to be home by the early afternoon. Shelley felt a returning apprehension, and as she made breakfast and sat down at the table to eat, she forced herself to count her blessings. She had no idea what Mira's news could be. But if Burnham Wood was truly within sight of solvency at last, then she could quit the group with a clear conscience. No one could accuse her of abandoning Mira when her chips were down. Mira would be returning in a good mood, which would make her well disposed towards the news that Tony had come home. And her announcement, whatever it was, might well provide the perfect chapter break for Shelley to announce her own intention to depart. The hui was at 7 that evening, and Mira would be back by 2. There would be ample time for conversation in the later part of the afternoon, and ample time for Shelley to tell her friend once and for all, without fear and without embarrassment, that although she wouldn't change her years at Burnham Wood for anything, it was time, she practiced saying it out loud. It was time for her, finally, to move on. As she showered, she wondered if Tony would make an appearance. It seemed unlikely, since he hadn't touched the open source folder or responded to any of her calls for volunteers, and she hadn't seen him at any of the planting sites, and nobody at Burnham Wood had so much as mentioned his name, even in passing, even just to remark that he'd come home. But to reassure herself, after she had dressed and dried her hair, she opened her laptop and sent out a group email on the Burnham Wood mailing list, reminding everyone of the hui that evening, and asking for a quick confirmation, for catering purposes, of who was planning to attend. They held their assemblies in a cafe managed by one of their long-serving members, Amber Callender, who would remember Tony, though in Shelley's recollection they had not been friends. And it had become a tradition to mark each quarter with a ceremonial bowl of soup, the ingredients sourced from Burnham Wood planting sites, and prepared in the cafe kitchen by Amber herself. Shelley had been so preoccupied with her own intentions for sending out the email that she had forgotten that hosting was a source of great pride and satisfaction for Amber, and that Amber, whom Mira had once described unkindly as a walking list of grievances, was notoriously quick to take offense. Almost immediately, Amber fired back with a reply all, asking in a tone of deep affront if Shelley was taking over the task of catering, because she'd already laid on a dozen heads of broccoli, and she would have appreciated a bit more notice in the event of a change of plan. And Shelley's email had made it seem that there was a reason to expect a greater crowd than usual, which might be a problem because they were already nearing capacity in terms of how many people could legally cram into the cafe at once. And fire hazard violation fines were quite expensive. And while she had the future of the cafe to think of, at the same time, she really didn't want to have to be the one to turn any members of the group away. By the time Shelley had made amends, she was obliged in the end to send a second email, clarifying that Amber was of course cooking as usual, thanking her publicly for hosting once again, and adding, so as not to debase herself too thoroughly, that it might be worthwhile attending because Mira would be making a surprise announcement. She'd received more than a dozen emails of confirmation. One of the names, Finn Koford Nielsen, she didn't recognize, until she saw that he had signed off Finn K, and she realized that this must be the crust punk whom she'd only ever known as Fink. She hadn't even realized that his email address was still on the mailing list, as he hadn't attended any of their meetings in at least a year. Curious as to what might have drawn him back, she looked him up on Facebook to discover that in the time since she'd last seen him, he had exchanged his glued mohawk and eyebrow rings for a pair of stylish, thick-rimmed glasses and a military fade. According to his profile, he was now respectably settled and working for his local district health board as a software engineer. If she hadn't been looking for it, she wouldn't even have recognized that he was the same person. Diverted, she began swiping through his profile pictures to see if she could pinpoint the exact moment his appearance had transformed. And nearly 15 minutes went by before it occurred to her that if Fink's address had remained on the listserv all this time, then perhaps Tony's had as well. She called up the mailing list again and scrolled through the addresses, and sure enough, he was there. gallos.humor@gmail.com. Funny that in all the years he'd been away, he'd never asked to be unsubscribed, she thought. And then she felt embarrassed when she realized that everything she'd told him during their conversation at the bar about how much Burnham Wood had changed in his absence must not actually have been news to him at all. She spent the morning tidying the flat, and after lunch she cycled to a nearby hardware store to ask about collecting sawdust from beneath their on-site crosscut saw. The duty manager, a young man she hadn't met before, looked amused when she explained that she wanted the sawdust for her compost heap. But his amusement faded when she added that it was useful both to aerate the heap and to provide a carbon boost to complement the nitrogen, and that she had found the ideal compost was formed of plant matter, sawdust, and animal manure, at a ratio of 1:1:3. Grudgingly, he allowed her to sweep up a small bag of sawdust at no charge. But his manner had become curt and disapproving. And as she cycled home, Shelley reflected that in all her years at Burnham Wood, she'd never quite mastered the skill of knowing in every individual circumstance whether to overplay or underplay her expertise. There was something that Mira seemed to know instinctively. That a demonstrated competency reassured some people and aggravated others. She could pitch herself at exactly the right point between whimsical amateur and winsome entrepreneur. A performance that, when Shelley tried it, only seemed to make it much less likely that the person she was talking to would want to give her things for free. It was past 3 o'clock by the time she had dug the sawdust through the heap, and she checked her phone to find a message waiting from Mira. The van had broken down a little south of Timaru. She'd had to call roadside rescue, and she was now waiting for a mechanic to determine whether the problem was fixable within the next few hours. If worst came to worst and she didn't make it back in time for the hui, she'd call and relay her announcement over the phone, but she'd much prefer to break the news to Burnham Wood in person if she could. She sounded harried, and Shelley hesitated for several minutes over what to reply. She typed out an experimental message. Okay, crazy, Tony Gallo's back in town. He stopped by the flat a while back looking for you. Not sure if he'll come tonight, but just FYI. I just realized he's still on the mailing list, so it's conceivable he might show up. Anyway, fingers crossed the van gets fixed. Let me know how you get on, XX. She stared at it, chewing her lip, for a long time, before pressing delete. Tony hadn't RSVP'd, and among the 30-odd members who now had, the only people who had any connection to him whatsoever were Amber, who had never much liked him, and Fink, whom he'd never much liked. In all probability, he wasn't coming, and there was no need to warn Mira in advance. Bummer, Shelley wrote instead. Hope it's fixable. Keep in touch, XX. She passed the rest of the afternoon preparing sets of peas and lettuces. For the last few days, she'd been soaking pea seeds in sources of water to hasten germination, and at last they'd begun to sprout. And cleaning out the busted drinks fridge that she and Mira had brought home from the tip and were planning to convert into a greenhouse. A little after 5:30, Mira texted to say that the van had been fixed at last and she was on the road again. She would drive straight to the cafe, arriving only a little late. Save me some soup, she wrote. Only, remind me who's cooking again? Grinning, Shelley sent back a witch emoji. Then washed up, locked the house, and strapped a box of seed trays onto the back of her bicycle, figuring she would just have time to deliver them to empty plots around the city before it was time to head to the cafe. The wind was against her, and she misjudged the distance between two of their most recent planting sites. She arrived at the hui 7:20 to find the windows steamed, and the scent of lemongrass and coriander wafting out into the open air. As she locked her bike to the parking meter, she had a sinking feeling that she could hear Tony's voice. And when she opened the door, her heart sank even further. She was one of the last to arrive. The tables had been stacked against the window, and the chairs arranged in an ellipsis. And at the top of the ellipsis, Tony was holding court. He was addressing Amber, who was still wearing her chef's apron, and whose body language made it clear that she was decidedly put out. They hardly looked up as Shelley slipped in. You're still inside the paradigm, Tony was saying. Can't you see? You're still treating people as consumers. You're just saying that they should consume more responsibly and consume less. But as long as you keep talking in the language of the market, you're never going to address the root cause of the problem, which is the market itself, and how we've all become so fucking individualistic and consumeristic that we can't even conceive of anything anymore except in market terms. If we want to mount any kind of serious challenge to neoliberalism at all, we have to go way deeper than just changing our spending habits. We have to change the way we actually think.
Well, that's easy to say, Amber objected,
but Tony was still going. Like, think about the fact that nobody's willing to use the language of morality anymore. We can talk about power. All we talk about is power, who's got it and who wants it. And we can talk about privilege, which is basically the same thing, entrenched power. But to use words like good and evil, or not even evil, just good and bad, when it comes to people's behavior, or their lifestyle choices, or their forms of self-expression, their freedom, that's like totally taboo. Especially on the left. Where do you think we got that from? It's the market. The idea that human choices can never be without morality, without a moral dimension. That's pure capitalism, seeing the market as a value-neutral place where morality doesn't exist and people are free to compete on equal terms. And there are, like, natural laws of supply and demand or whatever. And of course it's all bullshit. Markets are created. They're always created. They're always policed and regulated and interfered with by the state. But we totally repeat that same logic, don't you see? We treat power both as an absolute, as a natural law, and as something that's completely relativized in terms of moral value. So basically, exactly the same as how we think about so-called market forces. There's no difference. And the sad thing is that we can't even see that we're doing it. We think we're above this shit. We're inside it. Shelley looked around the room, suppressing an urge to turn, walk back out the door, and disappear from Burnham Wood forever. Although everyone was quietly eating, she felt she could detect a note of glee in how closely Tony's words were being followed, and how disinclined they all seemed to interrupt. Amber was not well liked among the group. She was touchy and officious, proud of her seniority and jealous of her rights. And there were many, Shelley included, who would be only too glad to see her scolded in public, and possibly even shamed. Even so, something about Tony's energy made Shelley uneasy. He was sitting forward on his chair and giving his opinions eagerly and quickly, like someone who had been prevented from speaking for a very long time. He kept glancing towards the door.
Or like the term free market, he was saying now. It's totally a propaganda term, and yet we all use it, even on the left. It's insane. We should be asking ourselves, why are we using their words and their logic? Why are we doing their job for them?
But I didn't use that word, Amber said. I never said free market. All I said, I know, but my point...
Shelley went over to the kitchen hatch. What's going on? She asked the person serving, a soft-spoken session drummer whose name was either Callum or Colin. He shrugged.
I guess his name is Tony. He showed up with Finn.
Who? Shelley said stupidly, before she saw that Tony was sitting next to a well-groomed young man with glasses and a military fade.
Oh, right, she said. What are they talking about?
Capitalism, I think.
He ladled out a bowl of soup and passed it to her. Didn't we already solve that one?
Oh, said Callum or Colin. You should tell him that. I dare you.
Shelley thanked him for the soup and went to find a seat. Smells fantastic, she whispered to Amber as she passed her, holding up her bowl. But Amber didn't smile. Shelley noted with annoyance that Amber was the only one in the room who wasn't eating.
Addicted to martyrdom, Mira would have said, rolling her eyes.
You know nothing would make her happier than if it was all gone by the time she went to serve herself. She'd be over the moon. Tony was still talking.
As long as you keep treating the individual as the basis of political agency, he was saying now, you're going to be stuck with different forms of capitalism. This is my whole idea. This is what I'm trying to write about. What if we stopped talking in terms of individuals at all, and instead we took the relationship as the base socioeconomic unit? The relationships, the bonds, the connections, they're just as basic to any system as the actual individuals, the actual data, right? And in relationships, we do all sorts of things that radically challenge the neoliberal status quo. We make sacrifices, we put the other person first, we learn to compromise, we care, we help, we listen, we give ourselves away. And fundamentally, those are different kinds of sacrifices to the kind that are all about self-discipline and following a regime. They're not individualistic, they're mutual. Like, all the stuff that you were saying before, stopping eating meat, flying less, shopping local, I mean, all power to you for sure. But there's something so puritanical about it. Like, it's a program of asceticism, always being strict and consistent and never being lazy or whatever. And at the end of the day, it's still about you as an individual, your purity, your moral conscience, the sacrifices you've made. But you can't force people. There's something so joyless about the left these days, Tony continued, so forbidding and self-denying and policing. No one's having any fun. We're all just sitting around scolding each other for doing too much or not enough. And it's like, what kind of vision for the future is that? Where's the hope? Where's the humanity? We're all aspiring to be monks when we could be aspiring to be lovers. The door opened and he glanced up again, but it was just a smoker returning from a cigarette break. But you can't force people into relationships, Amber said, taking advantage of the momentary pause. And even when you're in a relationship, you're still an individual. Tony was following his own line of thought. Take the concept of equality, he said, turning away from Amber slightly to address the rest of the group. You could argue that it's only really meaningful on a human scale. In large numbers, all it means is homogeneity, or conformity. Huge numbers of people who are exactly the same. I mean, who would want that? It's oppressive, it's inhuman, it's boring. It's everything everyone says about communism and how deadening it is. But between two people, equality is a totally radical idea. I mean, how amazing that two different people with different values and different experiences and abilities and needs, that they could see eye to eye and live in such a way that brings out the best in both of them, right? And allows both of them to flourish. That's symbiosis. It's mutuality. It's love. That's just the kind of relation to the world that the left should be aiming for. Not where you have to help someone other than yourself, but where you want to. Romantic love. That would be our ideal, our political ideal. Amber was frowning.
But aren't you just doing exactly what you're accusing me of doing?
How is this not you talking in the language of the market? I mean, we literally call it the marriage market. That's within a capitalist structure, though. You have to, and we have to fight for equality. There was never a given. For most of history, marriage was about property. It was a transaction. You're making it sound, sure. But if it was the bond itself that was the economic unit, you're making it sound all cuddly and everything. But equality isn't the norm. There are power imbalances in every relationship. People are always being coerced and—
But if we took an ideal of non-coercion—
Like being exclusive, Amber said, cutting over him. That's just a kind of ownership, right? I could just throw all this back at you and say you're being so capitalistic and individualistic for assuming that relationships have to be, like, monogamous and traditional.
Oh, give me a break, Tony said. Polyamory is so fucking capitalistic.
Yet again, you're proving my point. You literally couldn't have picked a more individualistic example.
Amber looked confused. What?
It's consumerism 101, Tony burst out. It's like going to a department store. The idea that this partner gives you a little bit of this and this partner gives you a little bit of that and you don't want to risk missing out so you buy them both, it's a hedge. You're like one of those people at restaurants who order something off the menu and then reserve the right to change every little part of it. No tomatoes. Can I swap out the bread? Sauce on the side. It's like just eat it. You're not fucking allergic. Your life's not in danger. You're just picky. You're just rude. It's so fucking self-obsessed and boring. It drives me nuts the way we talk about polyamory as if it's the new frontier, as if it's an act of protest, like you've transcended ownership and bravely liberated yourself from patriarchal structures or whatever, when it's literally the complete opposite. It's that you don't want to take moral responsibility for the fact that you want to fuck other people, or the fact that you can't commit, or the fact that you're unhappy and unfulfilled, so you just redefine morality so that you don't have to face your own selfishness and actually call it out for what it is. Polyamory doesn't lead to fucking socialism. It leads to hyper-egotistic, Mormon, hyper-capitalist—
Jesus, Amber said. I guess I hit a nerve or something.
Tony had flushed.
Here's the test, he said. Here's what you should be asking yourself. What if it was me saying, hey, what about polyamory though? That's a great idea, guys, isn't it? Me, Tony. You'd all be up in my face telling me it was the most patriarchal thing you'd ever heard of. But when it's you, all of a sudden it's supposed to be this amazing liberation. Shouldn't that tell me something? Shouldn't that ring any bells? That maybe you aren't as progressive as you think you are? That maybe there's some other power structure at work? This is just what I've been saying the whole time. I mean, intersectionality, neoliberalism, what's the difference? It's the same old bullshit.
Amber drew back.
Excuse me? She said. Just hear me out, Tony said. Hear me out, all right? Just listen. Any conversation on the left these days, it's always so competitive. It's always each person trying to outperform the person before them in terms of their oppression or their lack of privilege or their personal trauma or like the fact that actually they're Jewish or actually they're bisexual or guess what, they're a quarter this or that ethnicity, which gives them the right to speak or the right to take offense or whatever. It's a marketplace, yet again. You can dress it up in the language of sensitivity and social justice and blah, 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 but the point of intersectionality isn't to learn how to transcend our differences or eliminate them. The point isn't solidarity. It's about shoring up your brand, cornering the market, everyone out for themselves, maximizing profit and minimizing risk. I can't believe I'm hearing this, Amber said. It locks us into our differences, Tony said. It's segregationist, and it's also just advertising. It's brand management. That's my point. We're still inside the fucking paradigm.
He looked around, seeking agreement, but the mood had turned decisively against him. Shelley could sense it, and she could tell that Tony could too. They made eye contact for the first time that evening, and she felt, to her surprise, a surge of pity for him. His face was very flushed, and he had a wild, almost forsaken look, as though he were on the verge of breaking something that he knew he didn't have the means to fix.
Just so I'm clear, Amber said. You're saying that intersectionality is bullshit.
Oh, come on, Tony said disgustedly. Don't do that.
Don't do what?
Don't make out like I've stabbed you in the fucking heart just because,
oh my God, Amber said. This is not about me, Tony.
Yes, it is, Tony interrupted. Of course it is. You're getting offended. You're making a big performance out of how unbelievably offended you are. It's not a debate. It's not an argument. It's just another way for you to pull the identity card. It's the same old shit.
Next to him, Finn was shifting in his seat uncomfortably.
Hey, man, he said quietly to Tony. Read the room, maybe?
I am reading the room, Tony said. Everybody here is white. Am I wrong? Everybody here at this hooey...
He put exaggerated quotes around the word.
Is white and middle class, just like Amber and just like me.
This is so fucked up, Amber said.
If I'm wrong, please tell me, Tony said. Please, somebody put me straight, because I honestly would love to be corrected.
Shelley looked around her in dismay, for although the present company didn't show it, the membership of Burnham Wood had broadened in the years that Tony had been overseas. She did a mental headcount to assuage her ugly feeling of complicity. There was Winnie and Janan and Amara and Samir, all regular faces at Burnham assemblies. There were the Tamanis, the Fijian Indian family who sold Burnham produce at their corner store. Agnes Vai, a Samoan art student who'd signed up to help with household junk collections. Nancy Chen, a dentist who'd donated the strip of earth beside her parking space at work and who grew seedlings on her windowsill at home. Mr. Sachansa, who hosted a plot in his garden, his daughter Vanita, who hosted another on the other side of town. Kindly Mrs. Lee, who always bought more than she needed when they came knocking on her doorstep with produce for sale. And that was to say nothing of all the dozens of volunteers who were Asian and Pacifica, and Māori too. Surely there was someone present who was Māori. Wincing, Shelley looked around the room again, scanning all the faces, and caught the eye of someone on the far side of the ellipsis who was doing the exact same thing. They both flushed and quickly turned away.
You're being so fucking disrespectful, Amber said.
To what? Tony said. Your brand?
Like, is somebody filming this? Amber said, looking around. For the record?
Oh, sure, Tony said, throwing up his hands. Sure, commodify this moment. Go ahead, please, prove my point.
This is so fucked up, Amber said again.
Shelley raised her hand.
I feel like this has maybe gone far enough, she said. What does everybody think? Should we call it maybe?
There was a stirring of agreement around the room, but Tony wasn't about to back down.
Just hear what I'm actually saying, he said, still addressing Amber. Okay? Just actually think about the connection that I'm making. A marketing algorithm doesn't see you as a human being, right? It sees you purely as a matrix of categories. A person who's female and heterosexual, or whatever sexual, and white and university educated and employed, who has these kinds of friends and shares these kinds of articles and posts these kinds of pictures and makes these kinds of searches and on and on. And the more sophisticated the algorithm, the more subcategories it's able to diagnose, and the better it's able to market whatever it is it's selling. Identity politics, intersectionality, whatever you call it, it's the exact same thing. It's the same logic. The smaller the category, the better you're able to sell yourself, the safer you are economically.
That's so fucking cynical.
Yes, it is. And that's exactly what I'm saying. As long as we keep thinking like this, we're stuck with cynicism. There's nothing else. We'll never be able to agree to work towards a common goal, and that means the whole project of a genuine left-wing politics is fucked. How can we even get started on the project of creating and protecting public goods when within every interest group there's always a subgroup, and each one has their own particular agenda, and they're all in competition with each other for airtime and market share?
You talk about airtime, Amber said.
Literally. Look who's talking. Literally.
This got a laugh.
Sorry, Tony said. His flush had deepened. Okay, you go.
Well, Amber said, tossing her head. I don't think it's an accident that whenever anyone seems to have a problem with intersectionality, they always happen to look exactly like you.
Tony's expression hardened at once.
Oh, come on, he said. This is exactly—
And identity politics, that's also a propaganda term, by the way, Amber went on. People who are actually marginalized, people who are actually systematically oppressed, whose lives are actually in danger, they don't say, oh, have you heard about this great new thing? It's called identity politics. They're talking about justice and representation
and survival, someone said.
And survival, Amber said.
There was a flurry of nodding.
But I'm not against any of those things, Tony said. Not at all. That's not my point.
Maybe it's you who's still inside the paradigm, Amber said with growing confidence. Maybe you'd always taken it for granted that you were going to come out on top in the quote-unquote marketplace of ideas or whatever. But now these spaces that you've always monopolized have been opened up.
No, that's not what this is about.
And all sorts of people who have traditionally been excluded are now being let in and given a voice, and they're pushing you out and reducing your airtime and threatening your privilege. And you're like, hey guys, the world is so capitalist, everything's a marketplace, that's so terrible. And we're all like, yeah, we know. It's a system that you created, so why should we listen to you anymore about anything? Because guess what, Tony? Times have changed.
Around the room, people were snapping their fingers and voicing their assent.
Hey, I'm not arguing for the status quo here, Tony said, putting up his hands. Fuck the patriarchy. Fuck capitalism. Fuck white supremacy, 100%. Bring it all down. I don't want things to stay the same.
Oh, right, Amber said. Because it's such a novelty to be lectured at for literally half an hour by a straight white—
I just don't think that intersectionality is the answer to the problem.
Well, you know who else thinks that? Fucking white supremacists, Tony.
Look, clearly this is a touchy subject.
That's fucking patronizing.
But I'm not just being a dick, all right? I'm not just name-dropping and being a cliché. I've actually got ideas. I'm actually proposing an alternative.
Yeah, well, maybe you don't get to do that anymore.
But that's so crazy, Tony said. What kind of a solution is that? You can't just tell me to shut up.
I'm not telling you to shut up. I'm telling you to listen. There's a difference.
Several people broke into applause.
But listen to what? Tony said, starting to laugh. Can't you see what you're doing? That's not an argument.
Yes, it is.
It's not. It's just your fallback position. You say, listen, yeah, sounds great, awesome, but listen to what? You haven't got any actual ideas. All you have is your identity. All you have is your brand. You're just trying to promote yourself. Do you honestly not see that?
Let's look at what you're doing, Amber said. You, Tony. You come back after how many years? You completely dominate the conversation. You're rude and dismissive. You're eating the food that we grew and we cooked for you.
The food was delicious, Tony said. I should have said that.
And it's like, this is why intersectionality is important. You, right here, talking like you've been talking all night, laughing at me. This is the argument.
The door opened and Mira walked in.
So sorry I'm late, she said to Amber. It smells amazing.
Then she saw Tony.
Oh my God, fuck.
My sentiments exactly, Amber said, clearly hoping for a laugh that didn't come.
What?
Mira said, half smiling. She looked from Amber to Tony, but he wouldn't meet her gaze. He got up to take his empty bowl to the kitchen.
It doesn't matter, Amber said. Everyone's here now. Let's get on with it.
Mira was still trying to smile. Guys, she said, looking around. What did I just walk into? But a collective shame had taken hold.
It's nothing, someone said. Don't worry.
Amber looked nettled.
It wasn't nothing, she said in a prim voice.
She went over to the serving hatch and began straightening the spoons.
What wasn't? Mira said, appealing to Shelley.
What's going on?
This is all my fault, Shelley thought. This is absolutely and entirely all my fault. She glanced at Tony, who was rinsing his bowl at the sink, his back turned.
Maybe we should take five or something, she said. Cool off a bit.
I don't need to cool off, Amber said. I'm fine. I just want to get on with it.
You can leave that, she said to Tony, raising her voice louder than she needed to. We have a dishwasher, you know.
He pretended not to hear her.
Can someone just tell me what's going on, please? Mira said.
But people were starting to sigh and murmur their annoyance. And when someone said, actually, could we do that later? I have a babysitter and I can't stay past 9. Others began making the same petition, saying that they had work in the morning, or that they had to catch a certain bus, or that it was late enough already. And within seconds, the group had come to life. They began stacking their empty bowls, getting out notebooks, asking whose turn it was to facilitate, and reminding each other loudly of the schedule of topics for discussion. Mira hesitated, seeming unsure whether she should follow Tony into the kitchen or stay where she was. Shelley got up to go and speak to her, but Amber got there first, handing Mira a bowl of soup and a spoon and saying, underneath the hubbub, but loud enough for Shelley to hear, just so you know, Tony's turned into a real asshole. Mira caught Shelley's eye and made a quizzical face, which Shelley met with a miserable shrug that was half headshake, half nod. There was no time to say anything else. The facilitator called the meeting to order, and Tony crossed the room again and resumed his seat, not responding to Finn's look of pained commiseration as he sat down. Pointedly ignoring everybody's gaze, he folded his hands in his lap and looked at his shoes, ready to listen. Shelley sat back down again. Amber retreated to the hatch to serve herself, and Mira took her own place in the last available chair. Meetings at Burnham Wood were broadly horizontalist. The role of facilitator was allocated on a roster, this time to a sweet-tempered pediatric nurse named Katie Vander, and discussions proceeded through 5 set phases, putting forth proposals for action, asking for clarifying questions, raising objections and concerns, making amendments, and finally, testing for consensus, which was demonstrated by wiggling one's fingers upright to signal agreement, downward for disagreement, or sideways to indicate a stand aside. Katie began, as was always the custom, by reminding everyone of the format and then reading out the group's 3 principles of unity. To develop and protect a classless, environmentally sustainable, direct democratic economy that is both regenerative and responsive to human need. To operate as much as possible outside a capitalist framework, and to practice solidarity and mutual aid. The principles had been devised so long ago that ordinarily Shelley hardly paid attention. But now, with the substance of Amber and Tony's argument ringing in her ears, she felt a flush of guilt, first at the word capitalist, and then again at solidarity. She glanced at Tony, but his expression was impassive. He was still staring at his shoes. Mira's was the first proposal to be tabled, and after setting a time frame for the discussion, Katie gave her the floor.
Okay, well, hi, kia ora tatou, Mira said, looking around. So some of you know, I've just come back from Thorndike, down by the Korowai Pass, where there was that landslide recently.
Shelley felt another flush of guilt to observe that Mira seemed, unusually, a little nervous. Tony hadn't moved. "While I was down there," Mira went on, "I met this guy, kind of by accident, this American guy, and as we got to talking, he sort of expressed an interest in who we are and what we do. And this sounds a bit strange, but he's offered to give us some funding, like to help us to become a proper not-for-profit type of organization. I mean, if that's what we want. And I guess, like a kind of test, he wants to commission us to come and plant a garden on his farm to see what we're made of, and to see if we can handle a budget and a schedule and parameters and stuff." She was usually more fluent than this, Shelley thought uncomfortably, and more authoritative. "So his offer is $100,000, Mira went on. "Just cash, no strings attached, not as a contract or anything. This is just like a donation. He said that by Christmas, if he's happy with the work and we've proved that we're for real and that we know what we're doing and everything, at that point, we'd have another conversation about actual proper long-term funding and how to grow and what steps to take and all of that. But whatever happens, the $100,000 would be ours to keep." "I know it sounds mad," she went on, now addressing Shelley. "I mean, honestly, it kind of does to me as well, but he's like really, really rich, like really rich. And I think he's like one of those people whose self-mythology is all about spotting enterprising young people and making their careers. Like, he sees himself as this rebel, and when he found out about us, it was like, hey, one rebel to another. And I know," she added, talking faster and looking apologetically around the room. "Rich American buying a bolt hole in New Zealand. I mean, it's not exactly the kind of bedfellow any of us would choose. And he's totally one of those apocalypse preppers or survivalists or whatever you call them. You know, like, he got his pilot's license. He has a plane. He's bought this farm, like, totally off the radar. And he's even putting in a bunker, so full cliche. But for what it's worth, he's invested in this conservation project up north, so his heart's at least kind of in the right place. And I've talked to him a bunch over the past couple of weeks, and I don't think he's an entirely bad guy." "Who is he?" someone asked. But Katie put out her hand to shush them. Asking clarifying questions was a part of the second stage. "Sorry," she said to Mira. "Go on." "Well, I guess the only other thing to say is that he's already given me $10,000, Mira said, blushing slightly. "I didn't ask him to. We didn't make any kind of agreement or anything, and I was super clear that I wanted to run the offer past all of you before making anything official. But then he told me to check my bank balance out of the blue, and I did, and he'd already made the deposit. I think it's part of the self-mythology I was talking about, like being all theatrical about it. I have no idea how he got my bank details, and none of this is in writing either, by the way. That's the other thing. It's actually because we're so off-grid that he was attracted to us in the first place. So this is definitely not like a legally binding kind of deal. It's very informal. It's more like a bet. Or like a dare, like he's daring us. Or maybe, like, we're daring him. But anyway, that's the whole pitch. His name is Robert Lemoyne." Tony looked up for the first time since Mira had started to speak. "Robert Lemoyne?" he repeated. "Yeah," Mira said. "Hang on," Katie said. "Are we ready to move on to questions, Mira?" "Yeah, ready, thanks," Mira said to Katie. To Tony, she said, "You've heard of him?" They were looking at each other for the first time.
"He's the Autonomo guy," Tony said. "He's not just rich. He's a billionaire."
Mira blushed again.
"Well, like I said, not exactly the bedfellow we'd choose, but you think? He's literally the opposite of everything we stand for."
"Just making sure we're only asking questions," Katie said.
"What's Autonomo?" someone asked. "It's a tech company," Tony said. "They make drones. Surveillance drones," Mira said quickly. "Not the military kind."
Tony made a scoffing noise.
"Sure," he said, "because there's absolutely no overlap."
"Let's keep it to questions, guys."
"You must remember his wife," Tony said, addressing the others. "It was this huge deal. She was in a helicopter and it crashed for like totally no reason. And he just happened not to be on board."
"Tony,
I'm just saying," Tony said. "This is the kind of guy we're talking about."
"So not like an accident?" someone said.
"Well, it was a bit weird. I mean, a helicopter, that's like his actual field of expertise."
Shelley could see that Mira was trying to control her temper.
No one knows what happened, she said tightly. No one, including you.
Tony shut his mouth. They held each other's gaze for a little beat. But before Shelley could decipher the look that passed between them, Mira had turned back to the group.
Look, I mean, full disclosure here, she said. He's on one of those investor visas and he needs to sponsor Kiwi Enterprise if he's going to qualify for a passport. So this isn't just a straight-up philanthropic type of deal. He's getting something out of this too. And yeah, he's a billionaire. And if anybody had a problem with him just on principle, then I would totally understand. Absolutely. There are like 25 red flags, I get it. But again, for what it's worth, I've done a bit of reading about Autonomo online, and it honestly doesn't seem like they
buy up the Google searches, Tony burst out. They buy up all the search results so that you can only see the favorable stuff. These are like professional surveillance operatives. Of course you're not going to find anything.
Let's just stick to asking questions, please,
Katie said. This has nothing to do with his company anyway, Mira said. It's just him.
So essentially, Tony said, you're proposing to help a billionaire drone manufacturer buy a passport to our country so that he can fulfill his grand plan to outlive everyone else on Earth.
We're only doing questions, Katie said.
That was a question. I genuinely want to know the answer.
He's going to get a passport anyway, Mira said defensively. It's not like we're the only business that he...
Since when was Burnham Wood a business?
Amber spoke up from the kitchen.
You can have a not-for-profit business, you know, she said. Guess what? You can even have a socialist business, like an independent co-op. That's not a contradiction, Tony.
Tony shut his mouth again, crossed his arms, and resumed staring at his shoes. So in terms of time frame, Mira said, answering a question that hadn't been asked, it would be like a few months' commitment at least, starting as soon as possible in time for spring. And obviously it's not like the Korowai Pass is just down the road, so even if people can only commit for weekends and stuff, that's still a lot of driving and a lot of expense. And we'd have to have a big conversation about how to allocate the money. I mean, how much of that should go on transport and on sustaining the crew that goes down there, for example? She was addressing Shelley again. But $100,000, she said. I mean, and that's just the tip of it. That's not even the money he might actually commit. And when we're up and running, I mean, we could give ourselves proper salaries, potentially. We could go nationwide. This could be really, really big. If we wanted it to be. Her look was pleading, and when someone else piped up with a question, would there be accommodation on the farm, she didn't immediately turn to face the questioner. She was searching Shelley's expression, hopefully, beseechingly. And Shelley realized with a lurch that Mira was desperate for her approval. It struck her, with a kind of wonderment, that maybe Mira had been nervous not because of Tony, but because of her. Mira turned away to answer the question.
I assumed that we'd be camping, she said. When I was down there, I just lived out of the van.
So we might have to sort out a composting toilet or something?
Yeah, something like that.
How do you know he's good for the money? I mean, the rest of it.
Where's the conservation project he's involved in?
There's no chance he'd be taxed on the money, is there? Down the line. How did you actually meet him?
Yeah, how did this even come up?
Shelley hardly followed the discussion. She kept her eyes on Mira, the feeling of wonderment huge in her chest and in her lungs. Tony asked no more questions and made no further movement at all. When the conversation turned to objections and concerns, there was a loaded pause, everybody clearly expecting that he would be the first to speak. He must have sensed it, for without looking up, he said very quietly,
It's blood money.
This time Mira didn't try to argue with him.
How?
She said, with barely repressed impatience.
Drones are weapons of terror, Tony said, counting on his fingers. Mass surveillance is totalitarian and oppressive. The billionaire class undermines solidarity by its very existence. It's fundamentally unsustainable, it's regressive, and it's unjust. Citizenship should not be able to be bought and sold. Protest action should not be able to be commissioned. Jesus, do I have to go on? You're literally getting into bed with the enemy. You're violating every principle this group was founded on. Am I really the only one who sees that?
You've been away for a really long time, Tony.
Clearly.
I mean, maybe you don't understand how hard it's been for all of us, just trying to keep this going all these years, trying to break even every day.
Mira glanced at Shelley, who nodded, automatically at first, and then with conviction.
I do understand that, Tony began, but Mira was still going.
Sure, in an ideal world, would people like Robert Lemoyne exist? No. But in an ideal world, we wouldn't need this opportunity. We wouldn't be massively in debt. We wouldn't be struggling every day to get our message out. We wouldn't be in fucking existential crisis mode every single minute of our lives.
Everybody in the room was nodding now, apart from Tony.
You talk about violating our principles, Mira said. Tony, we're living our principles. The work we all do, the time and labor and effort we put into this every day, not to mention our own money, those are our principles.
So the blood money aspect doesn't bother you at all,
Tony said, raising his voice over all the sounds of sympathy and affirmation.
I really don't see how it's blood money.
Yeah, I guess you wouldn't, Tony said disgustedly, since you also don't see how this is totally fucking selling out.
Mira was now looking visibly angry. Can you calm down just a little bit, please? She said.
Look, this isn't him saying, hey guys, here's $100,000, now forget about Burnham Wood, go off and start a hedge fund. The reason he made this offer in the first place is because he's interested in us. He wants to see what's going to happen. He's curious. He's impressed.
Forget who he is for a moment and just think. Someone wants to give us money to keep on doing exactly what we're already doing, but just at a bigger scale and with a bigger impact.
What we're already doing,
Amber said to Tony, indicating the group.
Us.
Mira expelled a breath. And by the way, she said to Tony, this is literally the first real shot at solvency that we've ever had, like in all the years you've been away.
I'm confused, Tony said. Am I supposed to be remembering that this guy is so curious and so impressed and so interested? Or am I supposed to be forgetting who he is? Don't you see? You're cherry picking. You clearly know that this totally goes against our principles in every way. So just admit that you're not being rational here. This isn't reason.
Why are you even saying our principles?
Amber began. But Mira interrupted her.
Yes, it's a compromise, she said. Yes, there are things about the situation that we're going to have to think about really, really carefully. But there comes a point where refusing to compromise basically means choosing to be ineffectual. And how is that not a violation of our principles? Isn't that worse? To throw away everything we've done, all our hard work, just for the sake of being able to tell ourselves that we were right? Oh yeah, Burnham Wood, they don't exist anymore, but they sure had good principles.
But where does it stop, though? Tony said. I mean, don't you see, by that logic, there's really nothing—
No, Mira said, cutting over him. No, sorry, Tony, this isn't about logic. This isn't a thought experiment where you can just take my position to its logical extreme. And that's the point of the tutorial. This isn't a philosophy class. This is a real, practical choice that we face as a group about the problem of how to sustain ourselves moving forward.
Hey, Tony said, what happened to direct democracy? I'm raising my objections and concerns.
And she's answering them,
Amber said.
So what do you propose? Mira said to Tony. I give the money back? I take it out of my bank account and physically hand it back to him?
Yes,
Tony said. And tell him, actually, sorry, Mr. Lemoyne, this is blood money in case you didn't know. So whatever we could have spent this on, however much good we might have done with this money, none of that matters?
Yes,
Tony said again. He crossed his arms across his chest.
100% yes.
Fine, Mira said. Duly noted. Any other objections or shall we vote?
The fucking vote?
Tony burst out, uncrossing his arms again.
We should fucking kill him is what we should do and call it collateral damage, like every civilian killed by fucking drone strikes in Iraq and Yemen and Syria.
Robert Lemoyne is not personally responsible for—
Absolutely he is. Absolutely he's responsible. Fucking go and kill him then,
Mira said, losing her temper at last.
I'll give you the address. Go and kill him, since things are so fucking black and white, and you're so pure, and so ideologically consistent all the time, and everyone else is such a hypocrite, and you're so ashamed to even be here. Go!
All right, said Katie. I think we—
You know, you don't have to stay,
Amber put in.
You're free to leave, you know that. Any time. I think we should move on, said Katie firmly.
Tony's expression was cold.
I move to make this a consensus vote, he said. Not just a majority.
Majority is consensus, said Mira. If everyone agrees to go along with the majority decision, then you've got consensus. That's how democracy works. If you have 90% agreement on an issue, that isn't inherently more democratic than 60% agreement. Democracy isn't about everyone voting the exact same way. It's about whether you agree to go along with the outcome of the vote, even if it turns out you're in the minority. That's consensus.
Mira, Katie said, I think he gets it.
I'm in, Shelley said.
Really?
Mira said, turning to her with a look of such naked relief and gratitude that Shelley felt her heart swerve in her chest. But whether from endearment or from shame, she wasn't sure.
Yeah,
Shelley said, smiling at her.
$100,000, man, bring it on.
They took the vote. Tony left the cafe shortly afterwards. And the following day, Mira and Shelley boxed up their belongings, cleaned the flat, placed an advertisement for a sublet, gave their house keys to a friend, and loaded up the van a second time. And as they backed out of the driveway, selected a playlist and left the city for the open road, 500 kilometers away, under a vast, unsmiling portrait of Queen Elizabeth II, Mr. Darvish knelt, and Sir Owen arose.